podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses. Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I said, I'm kind of used to being the boss of you, and I've been your mentor, and I was Michelle's boss. And so he says, yeah, but I'm going to be the president of the United States. I think you should do this. So the president of the United States, who's also like one of your best friends, asks you to do something, you go.
I'm Sally Christensen, the founder and CEO of Argent, a women's workwear brand. And this is Work Friends, a podcast for those who take their work, but not always themselves, seriously.
Work Friends.
Today on Work Friends, I am joined by Valerie Jarrett. Valerie is the chief executive officer and a member of the board of directors of the Obama Foundation and joins us weeks after the opening of the Obama Presidential Center in Chicago. With a start to her career in law, Valerie transitioned to public service in the 80s, where she came to know a young organizer by the name of Barack Obama through his soon-to-be wife, Michelle Robinson. As President Obama began to pursue and then occupy the highest office of government, Valerie left her career in local politics to join him. Between 2009 and 2017, she was the senior advisor to the president, the longest-serving advisor in her role, where she chaired the White House Council on Women and Girls and advocated for paid leave and criminal justice reform, among other issues. Today, in addition to her role at the Obama Foundation, Valerie is the board chairman of Civic Nation and sits on several esteemed boards, including the Ralph Lauren Corporation, the University of Chicago, and the Sesame Street Workshop. Her work in public service and beyond is exemplary, and I'm honored to have her in the guest seat today. Now on Work Friends, Valerie Jarrett.
Valerie, I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
This is our first time ever meeting, but we have admired you. I have admired you from afar since before starting Argent, and it's been over 11 years that I've been working on it. So,
well, thank you for that.
And it's an honor.
It's a delight. I've heard so many wonderful things about you.
Thank you.
But I'm delighted to finally meet you.
Thank you. So we are just catching up a few weeks after the opening of the Obama Presidential Center. How are you feeling?
So proud. Unbelievably proud. A very good friend of mine said, it's as though somebody sprinkled pixie dust all over the campus. And so not only was the opening fabulous and just fun and exciting and entertaining, and I had said to people, you're going to be on your feet dancing, and people were going, what? And then they were on their feet dancing. But then the day after, we opened to the public, and every day since then has just been so unbelievably joyful to see people come to the campus. And some people don't have tickets, they just wander around the campus and enjoy the great outdoors and all the art that we have and the playgrounds and walking trails. And you can walk from our campus over to the Museum of Science and Industry and then the lakefront, which is magnificent in the summertime. But those who go through the museum, we had to put Kleenex boxes throughout the museum because people are just sobbing for a whole host of different reasons.
Sure.
They're touched by it. But hopefully not just a sense of nostalgia, but a sense of the infinite possibilities that lie ahead. That's really where our secret sauce comes in, is not just looking backwards, but to look forward.
I love that. Yeah, I mentioned this, but I lived in Chicago for a brief stint after undergrad, and I cannot wait to get there and see it. It just looks incredible. The feedback has been remarkable, and it's very needed right now.
It is. And I'm so proud of the team that we have working there, because we do these surveys when people leave and we ask them, you know, what they thought. And what almost everyone comments on is just how warm and friendly the staff are. And that's everybody from the visitor services people to the custodians to the security guards. Everyone's job is to just really make this experience wonderful. And the people who work there, we hired a lot of people who live in the surrounding community, and their sense of pride for having this opportunity to showcase and to show people, look where I work at the Obama Presidential Center, just helps reinforce the positive experience people are having.
It's so emblematic of that brand, too, of hope and joy and optimism. Okay, there's a lot that we're going to get into. First, I want to start with our icebreaker, which is hearing about your biggest oh no moment in the past week. What's gone absolutely sideways and how did you handle it?
Oh no, in the last week. Well, So one of our elevators got stuck at the campus. Fortunately, no one was in it, but we were trying to figure out, like, why is the elevator not coming? And I realized it got stuck in between floors. And so needless to say, we'll be talking to the head of that elevator company today to find out. Because if it had been me stuck in the elevator, it would have been a real problem because I get claustrophobic.
Totally.
So I was like, what do you mean the elevator didn't move? So fortunately, no one was in it and no one got hurt, but it did kind of, it was a good wake-up call without any consequences to say we got to make sure these elevators are very smooth.
I mean, one example of a million, I would imagine, that you have to think about when opening something like this. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. So you spent the first few years of your life in Iran.
Yes, I was born in Iran. My parents were over there in the 50s with my father helping to start a hospital in Shiraz, Iran, and I was the second baby born in that hospital.
What stands out about that environment in terms of coming of age, or do you have any memories of it?
Because
left pretty young, didn't you?
We left when I was five, but we went back frequently until I graduated from high school. Mm. So I still have very vivid memories. And obviously back in the 50s, the United States and Iran had very strong diplomatic ties. And my father was in the army here, and he grew up in D.C. My mom grew up in Chicago. And after he was leaving the army, they were looking for an opportunity for my dad in academic medicine. And as a black doctor in the 50s, he could not find the kind of job that he wanted. And so he and my mom were kind of adventuresome spirits. So they said, well, let's look outside of the United States. And they were looking to improve healthcare delivery systems throughout the country. And so he went to start the Namazi Hospital. And so we stayed there till I was five. And then we moved to London for a year. And then in London, he continued the research that he had begun in Iran. And it caught the attention of folks at the University of Chicago, which is the same neighborhood where my grandmother and my aunt and all this extended family live. And so my father used to always say to me, you know what? If I hadn't taken that job in Iran, I wouldn't have landed right back where I wanted to be. So this is a good life lesson. But what I remember the food, which was delicious, the weather, which was perfect, the people who were warm and welcoming to us. My mom was the first woman to get a driver's license in Shiraz, Iran. And so she was kind of, you know, people look at her. But it was a country at that point that was very interested in being a part of the world, and they were hungry for information about the United States. You know, the United States was really highly regarded. And so for me, it was a great place to live on a hospital compound adjacent to the Namazi Hospital with families from physicians from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so we spoke French and English and Farsi and mumbled them all in the same sentence. And I learned a lot about people, which is that people are people. Regardless of where they come from, you're going to find something in common. And when you do that as a child, it kind of sets your expectations for life.
My dad is Turkish, so I spent mm-hmm. my summers in Turkey.
Yeah.
So I imagine we had a similar experience where culturally it's just such a warm, inclusive, communal, special place. I think
yes.
Iran's very similar to what Turkey was for me in the late 80s, 90s. It's changed a little bit, but still just that familial, like there's something to the Middle Eastern culture that's like really, really magical.
Yes, I agree. And a lot of the folks who we knew back then obviously left after the revolution, and many moved to the United States or to Europe. And so we kept up with a lot of friends, but really didn't know anybody. I don't really know anybody now who's still in Iran.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that makes sense. How would you describe as a child the shift from Iran, London, Chicago?
For me, it was hard.
Yeah.
Because, Iran was home. And so suddenly I'm in England, and it was very different there and was cold, and mm-hmm. I didn't know anyone. And then we moved to the United States. For my parents, they were going home. And for me, it didn't feel like home. And so I went to great schools in both Iran and in London. And so I ended up, when we came to the United States, it was five and second grade. And so I'm, you know, the maturity of a five-year-old, but I'm in second grade and in the middle of this public school. And the 1 year in London, I had developed a British accent. And so I just stuck out like a sore thumb. And I got bullied, and I just didn't feel like I had a place in it. And I think back on it now how fortunate I was to have had this experience. And my father's work took him traveling most summers. He would go all through Africa and the Middle East. And I just wanted to go to camp like all the other kids. And so I felt really different as a kid. And I didn't tell my story because I thought it was an odd story. And I realized that we are our stories. And it took me a long time to really appreciate this extraordinary childhood my parents had given me.
You've touched on both of your parents, but can you talk about early examples of work and when you started imagining a career for yourself and what you were envisioning?
Well, I started out intending to go into medicine because my father was a physician, and I thought, okay, that's perfect. What happened? I was in college, and my sophomore year, I took organic chemistry, and it was the same semester that my boyfriend, who was in medical school, took me to his anatomy class. And that was the end of that, between the organic chemistry and anatomy. I remember calling my parents, and I'm like, I don't think I can do this. And my father's like, why would you? I never wanted you to do it. And I'm like, I was doing it to make you happy. And he's like, well, you should have asked me. Do what you want to do. And so, but the example both of my parents gave me, they were both in academics. My mom started a graduate school in early childhood education. My father was a pathologist, hematologist, and geneticist. And they taught me how to be working parents. And I used to go to my father's lab after school or my mom's classroom and just hang out until they were ready to come home. And they did the mighty juggle, as I always refer to it. But it did teach me about like hard work and persistence and excellence and kind of the core values that they live by. So I was really fortunate to have Barbara and Jimmy Bowman as my parents.
I think that speaks to the guilt, too, that a lot of working moms harbor, especially working parents in general, but working moms. I think that there is always this calculation of, do I stay at home or do I work? And I think that you just speak to the value of staying engaged and working in some capacity and how valuable it is for kids to see that modeling.
Yes. Well, I felt completely guilty my daughter's whole childhood. And when I wrote a book called Finding My Voice, and my daughter was pregnant when the book came out, and I remember we were interviewed by a good friend of mine, and the friend said to my daughter, what did you learn about your mom in the book that you didn't know? And my daughter said, I had no idea how guilty she felt. I thought she was a perfect mom. She taught me how to be a working mom. And I was like, could you have said that 30 years earlier? It would have been nice to have heard that when you were six, not when you were 30.
Totally. As a parent of an 8 and a 6-year-old now, I can tell you, they do make comments that make you second guess it sometimes. At the same time, my son the other day, I forgot what we were even talking about, but he said, I know that most CEOs are women, just factual to him.
Yes.
And I was
yes.
like, oh, that's great. You know?
Yes.
Not going to correct that one.
Do not change his mind. He'll find out later, but by then he'll be so shaped, he'll leave his expectation. And I will say, you know, and I say this to young working moms, I did stupid stuff. Like I'd work all day, I'd come home, put my daughter to bed, I'd work some more, and then like at 2 a.m, I'd be making baby food from scratch. Why was I making baby food from scratch? Mm-hmm. And then I kind of went to the other extreme, and I would always be the mom that would bring the paper goods to the potluck. Mm-hmm. Never had time to cook anything. And I felt this, you know, other moms were like looking at me because they'd made beef stroganoff or something. And I'm like, here I come in with the paper plates. And I realized now, like, you make choices and you should own the choices and don't feel guilty. And, you know, particularly for working moms, you feel as though to have it all means you're doing it all yourself. Why? Why do we put that unnecessary pressure on ourselves to try to be perfect when it is impossible to be both perfect as a mom and perfect as a professional? And perfect shouldn't be the standard. I mean, you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be really good.
Yes.
And you can be really good. And children, they just need you to love them and be consistent. And yes. You don't have to show up for everything. I used to say to my daughter, talking probably more to myself than to her, you know, if you have one good parent in your life, that's all you really need. And she's like, okay, fine. If that's what you tell me, then I guess I don't need a dad. And yeah. So she never grew up thinking there was this void because I was like, you have one parent who loves you.
Yeah, it is. It's such a balance. I do think that there is no room for guilt, and it's easier said than done. For me, my hack is I don't cook. I don't think about cooking. I don't touch cooking. My husband does all the cooking
That's
not eating.
That's perfect.
But
that's great. And did you say that to him from the start?
Yeah.
Like, this is not what I do.
Yeah, maybe a little bait and switch early on, but...
That's honest.
We got
just
married.
A little bit, but quickly, before you got married, I hope.
He got on.
That's good.
Okay, so you were considering medicine, and then at some point we made a pivot to law.
Yeah, not well thought out. My best friend was a couple years older. She was in law school. I couldn't figure out what else I wanted to do. I thought about going into clinical psychology because I majored in psychology. That degree did come in handy, but not for the reasons I had thought originally. And she said, just go to law school. It'll buy you some time. And so then I thought, well, okay. And then everybody had a plan at the end of college, but me, really. And so I kind of made up a plan. I was like, well, okay, I'll go to law school. I'll figure out why I'm there. I'll develop my passion for the law. I'll probably go back home to Chicago. I'll fall in love, I'll get married, I'll have a baby before I'm 30. I'll be, you know, some fancy lawyer, and I'll live happily ever after. And I checked off every single thing on that box, and 10 years into my 10-year plan, I was miserable, completely miserable. And I would say, as I'm in this fancy office on the 79th floor of what was in the Sears Tower in Chicago, and I would say, this must be somebody else's life, because I'm a joyful person. I wasn't meant to be miserable. And I phoned a friend, which is what you do when you don't have any idea what else to do. And he's like, if you're not happy, why don't you do something else? I'm like, what? And he says, why don't you consider public service? And he had worked for Mayor Harold Washington, who was the first black mayor of Chicago. And Mayor Washington had just been reelected for his second term. And my friend was leaving the law department of the city, going back to his law firm. And he said, just go for 6 months. You try it, you'll like it. And 8 years later, I left. So it was great.
I think you're speaking to two things that happen. One is we're forced to make these really big decisions early in life around majors and what you want to do with your future. And it's so much more fluid than we make it out to be. And we do lean on our peers and all kinds of input from other people. Oh, my buddies, and for me, all my friends are doing business. I generally have aptitude for that. I guess I'll just do that. It seems like a catch-all bucket. But we just don't know.
We don't know. And we feel pressured to know.
We feel
pressured.
And
so you make things up. And I literally just made it up because I was like, well, let me come up with something so I can tell people what I want to do. And I do think that your cohort and younger have more flexibility to have multiple different swings in their career. I mean, my parents' generation, you just stayed in one profession your entire life. Mine had a little bit more flexibility. But yours and the next one down, I think, will have infinite possibilities, and it'll be more acceptable to change because people are all changing. Everybody's changing.
You touched on this. So you built an incredible career in Chicago working with Harold Washington, Chicago's first black mayor, then mayors Eugene Sawyer and Richard Daley. When did then lesser known Chicago family, Barack and Michelle Obama, come into your orbit?
So 35 years ago, almost to the day, July of 1991, Michelle Robinson came into my office. She'd been referred to me by one of my dearest friends who was the head lawyer for the city, and she said, this young woman is at a big law firm, she's miserable, she's supposed to be really smart, would you interview her? And I was at that point Mayor Daley's deputy chief of staff. And so she walks in, she's confident, she looks me right in the face, shakes my hand, she sees her resume on my desk. She never mentioned anything about, you know, Princeton undergrad, Harvard Law, Sidley Austin. She told me her story. And I was so impressed knowing how self-conscious I had always been about my story. Mm. And she said to me, you know, why did you leave your law firm? And I said, well, I was miserable. But I said, but if you want me to be honest, the real reason I left is that I had a child, this child I'd always wanted. And I was always so proud of my mom professionally. And when I looked at Laura, I thought, if I stay in this law firm, she will never be proud of me. I'll never really be anything that's worthy of the way I felt about my own mother. And I said it was a great motivator because I separated from my husband at the same time that I had left the law firm. And I was like, okay, she's going to be looking to me to be her role model. What am I going to do? And so I said to Michelle, you know, why are you now considering public service? And she said to me, well, I'm not that happy either. And my father and my best friend both died within the last year. Mm. And she said, it was such a wake-up call, you know, about the finality of life and that you can't take any days for granted and that you really have to make the best of your life. And she said, both of them, their lives were cut short. So what is she going to do to be purposeful and intentional and give back? And so I was blown away. So I offer a job on the spot. wisely, she demurs and she said, let me talk to you in a few days. So a few days later, I'm talking to her and I said, well, what do you think? And she said, my fiance doesn't think it's such the greatest idea. And I'm like, why not? And she says, well, she's not so sure it's a great move. Do you think you would be willing to have dinner with us? And quite wisely, in retrospect, I said yes. And so we had dinner. And I remember thinking three things at this dinner. Number one, they were going to be married forever, because you could just feel not just the love and the attraction, but the respect. They listened to one another. She cared about his opinion, which is why she wanted the three of us to have dinner. And for people who've said to me, you know, well, why did she have to have her fiance's approval? He's never made a single decision in his career without her sitting right there, too. So it was a reflection of the kind of partnership they were going to form. I thought, she's going to take this job, because it went really well. And I thought, you know, he's so interested in public service, and he's obviously so gifted. And he just finished law school, so he's young. And I said, you know, I bet one day he could be mayor of Chicago. And as he points out quite regularly, I underestimated him. Although that is a pretty cool job. But that was kind of my ceiling of what I thought a black person could achieve, because that was what I had seen. And so he kind of broke through that glass ceiling, to say the very least. But I do remember the other thing, Ed, which you will appreciate in light of our earlier conversation. At dinner, he's quite prodding in a very disarming way. So he said, so where are you from? I said, Chicago. He said, oh, did you grow up here? I said, yeah. He said, were you born here? And I thought, I'm going to have to explain Iran to him right now while I'm trying to get his fiance to come and work with me. I said, no, I was actually born in Iran. And I expected what I normally get, which is kind of a strange reaction, like, oh, how odd. And instead, he said, well, that's interesting. He said, you know, I lived in Indonesia for a while. And I said, well, that's interesting. And so we got into this whole conversation about what we had learned from these childhood experiences that shaped us so fundamentally about appreciating the United States in ways that people who have not lived in underdeveloped countries don't appreciate, about the freedoms that we have in a country such as the United States compared to those two countries, and the sense that you can walk in a room and find something in common with anyone, and then finally that this is an amazing country. It's not actually the only country on earth, if you're willing to be open and listen and engage. And I realized that if I had just said to him, oh yeah, I was born in Chicago, we would have never opened up this whole conversation of what we had in common. And so I always say to people, and when you're in a job interview, tell your story.
Can I ask, your pivot to public service, did it fulfill what you felt like you were missing?
Completely.
And was it immediate, or did you have to sort of seek it out?
I walked into City Hall, I knew I was where I belonged. And I remember my mom, for reasons I don't remember, drove me to work my first day. Now, here I am married, I got a kid, I don't know why. My mom is driving me to work. Except maybe for her to say to me, I can't believe I spent all that money on tuition, and this is where you're going to go work. And I remember going, it's going to be great, it's going to be really good. And I knew nothing at all about what makes a city work. And I was curious, and I just wanted to learn, and I wanted to listen, and I wanted to be a part of something bigger and more important than myself. And it absolutely was my calling.
You recruit Michelle in to join you.
I did. She did say yes, yes.
And then it evolves into you moving into a new role with the Obama campaign and Obama administration.
I did. He was a slow creep on me. So when he ran for Senate, I chaired his finance committee after having tried to talk him out of running for the Senate, because he just lost a congressional race. And I thought, well, if you can't win a congressional seat, how are you possibly going to win a statewide office? And Michelle and I orchestrated a brunch at my home with our friends to try to talk him out of it. And at the end of it, I remember she said, well, if you do this and you lose, which you will, or then you're going to be done with politics and we just go get a proper job. And he says, if I lose this race, I'm out of politics. And she's like, I'm all in. Let's get this done. And I said to him, how are you going to raise any money? You don't know anybody in the business community. And he goes, you do. You're going to chair my finance committee. And I was like, well, that wasn't what I was expecting out of this breakfast. So I started with that. And then when he ran for president, I was a senior advisor to the campaign. But as the campaign got further down the line, I started spending more and more time on the road. And so at one point, my parents are convinced he could never win because, again, you know, they grew up during Jim Crow and their idea of what was possible was not this. And my mom was like, you have a day job. You're running a real estate company. How are you on the road so much? And I said, well, I can work from wherever. And the chairman of my company is supportive and he's going to be president. And she's like, no, he's not. And I'm like, no, yes, he is. And when he won, my mom said to me, how did you know that he could win? Not that he would win, but even that he could win. I said, because you guys raised me to believe that if you worked really hard and you were determined and you had a goal and you went after your goal, anything was possible. And she looked at my dad and she said, no, we didn't believe that. And I thought, what? But at that moment, I realized that they had raised me aspirationally, not shackled with their reality, but kind of free to discover my own. And what a wonderful gift that was for them to give to me, because it just never occurred to me that he couldn't win. Really, it was just, if we worked hard, of course he could win. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't, then he'd go do something else, and I'd go back to my life. And so if you don't try those things, then how are you going to ever be successful?
Was it ever a consideration to not pursue this? Like, because did you have to quit your job and go into this full time?
I did. I had to quit my job, and I'd just been promoted to CEO maybe a year before. And I'd been at the Habitat Company for 11 years. It was the largest multifamily housing developer in Chicago at the time. I loved my job. I loved Chicago. My parents were from Chicago. They lived there. My daughter was in school, but planning to return to Chicago. Everything was rooted in Chicago. But as the president said to me, he said, you know, I want you to come to Washington. And I said, I'm kind of used to being the boss of you. And I've been your mentor. And I was Michelle's boss. And so he said, yeah, but I'm going to be the president of the United States. I think you should do this. And the president of the United States, who's also like one of your best friends, asks you to do something, you go. And I never looked back. I never regret it. It was just every single day for 8 years, it was extraordinary.
I do think it also speaks to really great leadership, which is surrounding yourself by people that are going to be honest with you, that will push you, and that are better than you in what they bring to the table.
Yes. With every team I've ever formed, that's what I've been looking for. It's like, who's smarter, who knows more, where. And I think part of it is having taken on the first non-legal job I took on after I left the mayor's office was running the Department of Planning and Development for the city. Well, I was a lawyer. I didn't have a master's or a PhD in urban planning. And I was supervising all these people who knew more than I did. And I said to them, you know more than I do, so help educate me. Mm-hmm. And they were so surprised that I wasn't trying to like bluff it. And I'm like, no, I need to learn. Mm-hmm. And so I think having the humility to know what you don't know is really important. And people said to me, well, how is it working for your friend? And I think it made me a better friend, having been a senior advisor, because on really hard days, I knew why it was hard. And so if we were having dinner and he was distracted, I knew the reasons why he was distracted. And I think that made me a better friend. And I also think being such a good friend made me a much better senior advisor. We never doubted trust. He never questioned my motives. I would tell him what I thought. He wanted disagreement. He relished disagreement to make sure he thought things through. In fact, one time we were having an argument, I was exhausted. And I didn't really care that much, but I was just arguing for the sake of arguing. And I said, okay, fine. And he goes, don't give up. Keep going. This is just getting good. I was like, okay, all right, let's go back at it. So he liked being pushed. And I think that that's not the norm for politicians. Sometimes they really think they do know all the answers themselves. But the best ones, I think, are ones that surround themselves with people who will tell them the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to just gather differing points of view is so critical. Just understanding that you have a shared goal, a shared mission. I mean, that's true of the United States. I think we've lost the plot on what our mission is, you know. But I think understanding that we all have a shared goal and there's underlying trust there, it's the best way to maximize outcome.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it takes, you know, curiosity, because you've got to really listen. And he was so good at, like, in the White House, it's very hierarchical. So like the cabinet sits around the Roosevelt desk in the Roosevelt room, and their staff sit at the back bench, we would call them. And President Obama was always like looking at the back bench going, well, what do you think? What do you think? And there was one time we were making a big decision in the Oval Office, and he says, all of you guys agree? And we're like, yep, we agree. And he goes, does everyone on your team agree? And to the credit, the woman who was chair of the Council of Economic Advisers said, well, actually, one of the members of my team doesn't agree. And the president said, well, why is he not in the room? And we waited 10 minutes for this poor guy to run across from the old executive office building to the white, to the West Wing, into the Oval. And he comes in there, and like all the senior staff are there. And President Obama says, I hear you don't agree with this group. Tell me why. And he gulped, and he pulled it together, and he told him why. And the president said, well, let me think about it. And in the end, he ended up agreeing with the larger group. But just imagine how validated that young man felt, that the president said, I really want to hear and think about what you had to say. And so when he didn't end up getting his way, he was totally on board because he had the opportunity to make the case. And he said, okay, I made my case. And so it's a really good management strategy.
It gives me chills. That guy's got a book to write about that one event.
I know. I tease him about it all the time. He will remain nameless, but he's like, I was sweating bullets. I couldn't believe I walked in that room. Everybody was there.
Everybody, all eyes locked on him.
All eyes locked on him.
So I want to go back just a little bit and talk about the start of the Obama administration and your work being on this new stage with more eyes on you than ever. Did you come into that role with a certain goal or idea of how you wanted to impact the highest office of government? And how did you learn to navigate the weight of the role?
No, I did not have any idea what the impact would be. I knew from the portfolio of my responsibilities that they played to areas that I cared about. So, for example, I chaired the White House Council on Women and Girls, and I'd spent 30 years focusing on gender equity, and I lived the gender disparities, and so that was something that was really important to me. I oversaw the Office of Public Engagement, and that was, to our earlier conversation, intended to bring in the voices of the people who were most directly impacted by our decisions, and they could be, you know, a mom whose child had cancer, who was trying to figure out how to pay for the treatment. And so the Affordable Care Act, we wanted to hear from that mom to see what are the challenges. And oftentimes I brought in people who had different opinions. And so these wide array of constituencies didn't agree with each other, let alone with us. And it was important to the president to hear those voices. And so I was responsible for sorting them all through and making sure to be an honest broker. And then finally, the Office of Public Intergovernmental Affairs, and those are all of the state and local elect and county elected officials in the country, everyone but members of Congress. So I had the good elected officials. Mm-hmm. And it was because he knew they were closer to the ground and he wanted them to weigh in as well on all of our policies. And then the kind of the generic senior advisor title, which is every piece of paper, every policy, everything that went into him for a recommendation came through the senior advisors first. And so, no, I did not go in with a clear mandate other than I knew I had to work really hard. No one would ever outwork me. That was the way I was raised. And I knew his most important thing he had is time. And so part of my job was to make sure we thought things through before we brought them to him. And so the rigor of just ensuring that our teams were coming in with the most informed analysis to present to him. And then just to tell him what I thought, as honestly and as directly as I could. And sometimes, not often, but particularly in the beginning, I would disagree with him in front of the rest of the group so that they would see it was okay to disagree, mm-hmm. because he wanted that. But mm-hmm. when you have this power dynamic, it's up to the people with the power to level the playing field, to get the best out of people.
And you came in as a senior advisor. I think you just articulated the role pretty well. On a day-to-day basis, is that looking just wildly different?
Every single day was different. Yeah. Every single day. And the challenge, and this is not unique to the White House, but the challenge, of course, is, let's say he had 50 things he wanted to get done in the first 2 years. How do you move those 50 forward while dealing with the deluge of daily incoming, things that people cared about, that they wanted our response to, crises that came out of the clear blue sky that we weren't expecting. So you've got all this coming in at the same time as you're trying to push forward. And so figuring that out was really challenging.
It sounds very adjacent to being an entrepreneur.
It's very adjacent.
Just on a much larger scale.
It is quite adjacent to be. And you think about it, it was like a startup. We started in the White House with all new people. We'd never worked together before. We had to hire, I co-chaired his transition. We had to hire all new people for these political positions, the cabinet, senior staff of the White House, senior people in the agencies, and make the best players the best team. Mm-hmm. And that was really the goal of the first couple of years.
Were there any times when you had to push for change or for a certain decision that was not a popular opinion?
Most of the time.
Every single day.
Oh, my gosh. Well, there were so many times. I mean, you think about the healthcare, which was one of his signature domestic policy achievements, which is extraordinarily popular now. But at the time, it was not at all. And so we just had to keep pushing, knowing that once people felt the difference in their own lives and it was outside of the political realm, then it would be meaningful. But oh, it was like an uphill battle. A lot of what we did, look, we were all about hope and change. People don't like change, mm-hmm. not when it affects mm-hmm. their lives, mm-hmm. even if it's change that might be for the better. I mean, full circle, like the Obama Presidential Center, huge development in the heart of a community. And initially, people were really nervous about what's this going to mean for my neighborhood. And so what I learned in local government is you have to earn people's trust every single day. And you have to underpromise and overdeliver. And I think that lesson stood me in good stead in the White House and certainly to this day.
And I want to talk about gender equity specifically. So you spoke to your focus on women and girls. How did you advocate for these issues that mattered the most to you?
So the council was comprised of every agency in the federal government. It was the first time that a president had created a council where its sole focus was improving the lives of women and girls. So every policy, every program, every piece of legislation, we looked at it through the gender lens. And look, in a sense, it was my lived experience, so it was kind of easy. We did the research that showed, for example, issues that have to do with working families, so equal pay, workplace flexibility, affordable child care, opportunities for promotion. I mean, all of the things that working moms need in the workplace were ones that we were trying to figure out, is there a way that we can address it legislatively? The first piece of legislation President Obama signed was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act.
I remember it well, yeah.
And you know, it was really helpful because Lilly had been discriminated against because of her pay, but had no idea that there was a discrepancy. By the time she found out, the statute of limitations had expired. And so the purpose of the legislation was to toll that statute of limitations. But that was not good enough because employees are often penalized for sharing the pay. And so we tried to get additional legislation that would prevent penalization of people who disclose their pay. Paycheck Fairness Act, that did not go forward. But so we were looking at this basket of issues about working families. We were trying to get additional girls to go into the fields of STEM. So the whole gambit from healthcare to the economy to working family issues, we were trying to get every single agency in the federal government to focus on it and also working with state and local. So if we were unsuccessful getting, for example, equal pay legislation in the federal government, then we would go and work with mayors and say, well, what can you do at the local level to try to close these pay gaps? And we went to the private sector and said, voluntarily, would you at least just look at the data in your own company? I often use Salesforce as an example of a company where the CEO was completely committed to this issue, but it was brought to his attention by two women that they weren't getting the same pay. And he's like, that couldn't be the case at my company. And then he looked at the facts and it was actually the case. And so he closed that gap. And so our plea to the private sector was just do the research and see, because it's not just an issue for women now, because women are contributing mightily to the family income. And so if women aren't getting equal pay, then it's impacting the whole family. So these were the issues that I cared a lot about and mm-hmm. spent a great deal of time and President Obama, look, his mom was a single mom. His grandmother worked at a time when women were not in the banking industry. He's married to this extraordinarily successful woman. He's got two daughters. So we kind of had him with hello. And so having his weight behind enabled us to really make as much progress as we could.
How We Made Your Mother is a rewatch podcast that looks back episode by episode at the hit TV show, How I Met Your Mother. It's hosted by me, Josh Radner, along with series co-creator and my friend, Craig Thomas.
Follow How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
Gender equity is the thing that I care about the most. And I think that it is imperative that men are involved in the solution.
Absolutely. Well, men are still in power. Predominantly, particularly in the private sector. But the way I look at this, and I look at this through the whole lens of diversity, is that it is a strength. It is a competitive advantage. And we think about women who are out there buying stuff. Women are the ones that are the purchasing agents for the family. And you are going to make better decisions if you have people around the table that reflect your marketplace. And whether it's women, whether it's people of color, whether it's people from all over the world, everybody now is competing in this global marketplace. And so if you're only talking to people who think like you, you're not going to be competitive. And so I look at it through not just it's the right thing to do, but it's a smart thing to do.
Agree completely. And I think you do have to make that case in this patriarchy that we live in.
Yes.
Is that it's a better economic outcome. So
yes. And if you don't look at it that way, what happens when times get tough is they cut the things that are designed for gender equity, for example, as opposed to, oh no, we can't cut that. That's a core part of our business. Mm-hmm. We have to ensure that we're giving paid leave and paid sick days. And so many people in this country work without either. And that's just, it's having a devastating impact again on working families. And if you're worried, if you're, first of all, if you're coming to the work sick, that's not good. We don't want you in the workplace. If you're leaving your child without taking a proper either maternal or paternal, I believe in parental leave, not just.
Yes.
In fact, I think it should be equal, and it is. Agreed. In the places where I work. And I encourage men to do it. And even in the White House, ours was 3 months paid leave. And the senior men, I said, if you don't take it, then the people who work for you won't take it either. And to their credit, our senior men took it. And so then it just trickles through the entire organization. And I'll tell you a quick story where I knew we were making progress in the White House. So what usually happens before a meeting starts? If you're sitting around the table and everybody's in the room, sports. It's what men always talk about, right? Everybody talks about sports. And for those of us, like myself, who are not that into sports, you just feel a little left out. So you start the meeting two steps behind. So one day we were sitting in the senior staff meeting with the chief of staff, waiting for people to come in, and three women had just returned from maternity leave, and we were talking about breast pumps. And I said, we have finally made it. We're not talking about sports, we're talking about breast pumps. And the guys are comfortable because they've been listening to their wives talk about breast pumps too. So it was like a sign of a good culture.
To be able to have those conversations, and I think they are very much more prevalent now.
Yes.
I go back even 10 years, like 20 years when I entered the workforce. These conversations were not happening at all. We didn't have rooms for pumping.
No.
Men were certainly not participating in the conversations. There is a lot of progress that we've made and continue to make. A lot more that needs to be made.
A lot more that needs to go. But part of what I try to do, and I always said, look, I didn't tell anyone I was pregnant until I was like 7 months pregnant. I was clearly pregnant. It was huge. But I was afraid that they wouldn't take me seriously. And I would say things like, oh, I'm going to a meeting. Where was I going? I was taking Laura to the doctor. And in my place of business, people better tell me what's going on. I want to know what's going on in their lives. And I think you just, first of all, you miss out on the elixir of life, which is relationships. And if people can't come and say to you, I got a sick dad, you know, I need to take off a little bit of time, or I'm having some postpartum issues, and so can you help me? If they don't feel that they can come forward and tell you those things, for them it's exhausting, and you're not going to get the best out of them. And for me, part of my joy is taking care of my team. And how can I take care of them if I don't know what's going on in their lives? And I tell a story all the time about Mayor Daley, who was terribly intimidating. Scared to death of the guy, particularly when he first promoted me. I was just like, oh my God. And I remember being in his office with the person who recommended Michelle Robinson to me. And she's head lawyer. I'm running the Department of Planning and Development. And we're both looking at our watches. And he catches us. And he's like, why are you looking at your watches? And in a moment of truth that I don't think I would have done if Susan hadn't been in the room, because there's something about, you know, doing it together. I said, sir, the Halloween parade starts in 20 minutes and we're 25 minutes away. And he goes, and he, I thought, like, he's going to kill us. He's going to fire us. And he paused and he said, then what are you doing here? Why didn't you say something 20 minutes ago? Get out of here. And so Susan and I go rushing down to our kids' school. They were both in second grade together. And we get to the Halloween parade just as the door opens and out come these little darlings.
Oh.
And all I could think about is, what if I hadn't had the courage to speak up for myself?
Yeah.
And I would never have done that at the law firm. I would have just missed the parade.
It's so important, and that modeling is so important from leadership, but also from the bottom down. I think that's the beauty of actually Gen Z, is they're bringing a lot to work, but I do think that they're having conversations that we wouldn't have dreamt of having.
But it's also setting expectations. Like, yeah. I say to people, look, we run a not-for-profit. I'm not going to be able to pay you nearly what you might get in the private sector. And you're going to work really hard here. But you're going to feel a part of something bigger and more important than yourself. If that doesn't resonate with you, then don't come work here.
Mm-hmm.
But don't come work here and think that it's about you, because it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to be clear with people, because a lot of times they think it is about them.
Mm-hmm. As someone who has worked in public service as long as you have, did you ever aspire to run for office yourself?
I did, for a brief shining moment in time. When right before President Obama decided to run for president, Mayor Daley was trying to decide if he was going to run for another term. And if he didn't run for another term, I thought maybe I would run for mayor. And he did run for another term, and President Obama just decided to run for president. And so it was a brief moment in time, but I did seriously consider it then. And then I should say also, when President Obama was elected to the presidency, his seat in the Senate was vacant, and my family really wanted me to put my hat in the ring for that. And I thought about it for a moment, and it's so funny. He's like, I've been in the Senate, and I know what we're going to do in the White House, and I know you. He said, you don't want to be in the U.S. Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right. But my family completely disagreed. But again, you know, I had to listen to that quiet voice. And as it turns out, I was much happier in the White House than I would have ever been in the Senate.
Well, you made history as the longest standing advisor to any president, serving from 2009 to 2017. So it seems you did find fulfillment in that role.
I did. I would have stayed longer if he could have had a third term.
Oh, we all wish he could have a third term. Coming out of that role and leaving the White House, which I feel like that's its own conversation, how did you view your career change, or how did you define success? You know, on the other side of...
That's a really interesting question. So when I came out, I turned 60, like 2 weeks after the 2016 election. So obviously not a very happy time for us. And I thought, I've had the best job I could ever possibly have. And because I'd spent a good bit of time in the private sector, I didn't really have to work. And so I thought, well, you know what, I'm just going to be just like... do what I want to do every day and travel and be with my friends and be with my family. And then my daughter said to me, after she interviewed me for StoryCorps, she said, what would you tell a 30-year-old Valerie Jarrett? And I realized I had a lot to say to a 30-year-old Valerie Jarrett. And she says, why don't you write a book and talk about your story? And it'll be helpful to those young working moms, particularly out there. And so I did that. And then I joined a few boards, and then I officed with the Obamas in Washington. I stayed in Washington, frankly, because my daughter moved there, and so I was kind of inert. All right, let me just hang out here in Washington. And then, and I was going to be perfectly content just doing that. And my mom kept saying, when are you going to get a job? And I'm like, I have had a great job in my career. But she worked until the day she died at 96. So, you know, she set a pretty high bar in terms of work ethic. And I thought, well, I am working. And she said, it's not the same as it when it's yours, when you really feel the sense of ownership. And I tuned that out completely, as she says I was wont to do. And then when President Biden won, President Obama asked me to take on this job because the person who was in the job joined the Biden administration. And he said, just come for a couple of months and help me out. That was 6 years ago. So I'd been kind of an advisor all along, and I'd officed with them, but there's nothing like it. As you know, when you're in charge, you're in charge. And so I've enjoyed the last 6 years immensely.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I want to talk about your board work as well, mm-hmm. which you briefly touched on. But since 2017, you've become a board member at places like Civic Nation, Walgreens, Ralph Lauren, Ariel Investments, University of Chicago, and the Sesame Street Workshop. What does that work look like, and how does that uniquely challenge you in a way mm-hmm. that maybe your primary role doesn't?
It's a great question. So I'm past the stage where being on a board is like a notch on a belt. I don't need to be on any boards. And I felt that way since I left the administration. I feel like at this stage of my life, I have the luxury of only doing what I really want to do. And so the question I say to myself is like, who's on the board now? And is there somebody with my skill set on the board already? Because if there is, they don't need to, probably. Do I love the product and or service that the company is providing? Really, really love it, yes. And do I think that there's a culture on the board where I can make a difference? Is it that kind of a board? And if it's not yes to all of the above, then I just say no. And if it's yes, then I try to figure out, do I have time to do it? And I will say, I find that I have an infinite capacity to work if it's work I care about. Mm-hmm. If it's work I don't care about, then I have a very short attention span. Mm-hmm. And so, and one of the lessons I taught myself years ago before joining the Obama administration is every year I go through the exercise of a gut check to say, do you still feel the passion that you felt when you said yes originally? And if you don't, it's time to move on. And there have been a few boards where I have moved on and just said, okay, you know, after 4 or 5, 6 years, it's time for the next person to come in and fill that slot. So that's kind of how I have made the decisions. And I think right now I have the balance just right. I was overboarded a few years ago, I think. And it was a lot of time and a lot of effort. And you can't do it unless you're going to take it seriously.
No, it's a job in and of itself, for
sure.
It
really is.
And I'm glad you talked about deciding when to move on, because I think that joining a board is one thing or starting a job is one thing, but knowing when to leave, it's hard for people. It's the same with marriages, too.
Yes.
It's like, you know, there's...
yes.
I think it takes a certain level of confidence, you know, to move past these things that have become part of your identity.
Yes, I think that's true. I think it is true. But that's why I say you got to do it on a heart. You got to do it kind of in the light of day and just say, you know, this, your life is limited. Mm-hmm. Is this really something you want to do with this chapter of your life? Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, I did it for the experience, because the experience was really important. And now it's more like, what am I able to contribute? Because I've had a lot of experience. So. Mm-hmm. And now I learn something at every board meeting I go to, and I'm curious. And so it's a lifelong love of learning, but it's not the same as when I was 36 and joining my first board.
Yeah. So, okay, we're getting to the end, and we've touched on it, but I do want to speak more to this recent milestone, which was opening the Obama Presidential Center last month in Chicago. First of all, what does your role entail there, and what should all people know about the center if they're not yet familiar with it?
So I am the CEO for the foundation, and the foundation was created when President Obama left office, and we have leadership programs in the United States, Asia, Africa, and in Europe. We have a leadership program at Columbia and the University of Chicago. We have a Voyagers program that allows juniors and seniors in college to go through leadership training, but also have a summer experience where they can travel anywhere in the world they want to travel and work. And we pay for that summer experience, which is transformative. We have a program designed to help improve the trajectory of the lives of girls, adolescent girls, the Girls Opportunity Alliance, and we have a program designed to help the trajectory of boys and young men of color, My Brother's Keeper. And we do a lot in the neighborhood surrounding where the center is located. So the foundation is kind of the umbrella of these programs. And now we have the mothership, where we can have a physical presence on the south side of Chicago, this spectacular campus, and we will have new programs on physical programs located at the campus. So my job is to oversee the foundation and the center. And so right now we're looking at We have to fundraise, so that's a big part of what I do. We don't take federal money. We're not a part of the National Archives system, which means that we're actually not dependent on the federal government, which is a good thing, but it means that in addition to raising revenues from our tickets and restaurants and retail stores, we've got to still raise a lot of our annual budget for operating and also for capital and for programs. And so figuring out that budget and how we want to allocate our resources and how we raise those funds is a lot of my responsibility. And, you know, we'll have one person wants to have an event at the center for a wonderful not-for-profit, and then we have a paying revenue-producing client who wants to come, and we have somebody else who wants to use the space. And so part of what I do is try to figure out the equities between all of the different components and and what is the theory of the case? Like, what are we communicating to the public right now? And ensuring that our center is evergreen, that whatever we do, it's timeless and means it has to stay fresh and it has to stay relevant, but it also has to be consistently the story we tell about the administration. So it's a big job.
What were the biggest challenges, big or small, in just bringing the center to life?
Ensuring that it was able to, once we announced the opening date, ensuring that we were ready for that opening date, from the landscaping to, you know, ensuring all of the exhibits were perfectly in place. And President Obama had a lot to say about the exhibits. Obviously, this was a story of in part of his life. And how we constructed the museum, he was integrally involved in as well. He didn't want it to be a time capsule about his presidency, but the story of our country. So we begin with the Declaration of Independence. And so figuring out how to tell that story in a way that's relevant to people in their own lives was a kind of a unique challenge. And so now part of the challenge is to try to ensure that we are coming up with new ideas that are funded that can continue off infinitum into the future.
I'd love to close this out by asking for some advice.
Oh, sure. You see, I'm good at advice.
You're great at advice. I'm like, there's so many great sound bites here. Given the current state of the world and our government, what advice would you give someone who sees your amazing career in public service and aspires to follow a similar path?
Definitely do it. And start local. I think I learned so much in local government because your constituents are proximate. And it is a contact sport. You've got to be able to take a punch, and you've got to be in it for the right reasons, which enables you to absorb a lot of incoming pain that isn't really directed at you. It's directed at the government or what you stand for. Mm-hmm. And you've got to make sure that you have the internal fortitude to take that incoming without it either debilitating you or making you feel numb. And I think if your true north is service, that gives you the strength to kind of do that work. And you learn that at the local level, because people were my neighbors. They'd slip notes under my door. They'd lobby my 6-year-old daughter. They'd come to community meetings and scream at me. And I learned to listen to people regardless of the decibel of their voices. And that's easier to, it's an experience you can't avoid at the local level. I think sometimes people who, in a sense, higher you go in theory, the further away you are from the people whose lives you're touching. And so the magic of my job in Washington was that I got to keep those really important real stories front and center.
It's all of your advice I find to be invaluable across all industries. Like, it really isn't specific to politics. I think there's so much wisdom in your experience
Thank
and in
you.
Your advice. We've come to the end of our episode, which means it's time for my favorite segment, a quick game of Would You Rather?
Okay.
Would you rather start work at the crack of dawn or burn the midnight oil?
Crack of dawn.
Sounds like you're doing both, though.
Yeah, but crack of dawn is, I'm at my best at the crack of dawn.
Same. Would you rather go back to school to learn a new skill or teach what you know to a class of newcomers?
Teach what I know to a class of newcomers.
Would you rather teach a class of seasoned professionals or a class of elementary school children?
Seasoned professionals. Elementary school kids are scary.
Would you rather only answer emails with emojis or only answer calls on FaceTime?
Oh, calls on FaceTime.
Would you rather make the wrong decision quickly or the right decision slowly?
The right decision slowly.
Would you rather accidentally leave your mic unmuted or your camera on?
My mic unmuted.
I'm pretty,
yeah.
Would you rather start a career in public service in the 80s or in the present day?
In the 80s.
Valerie, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
This was incredible. Congratulations on the center. I also want to mention, and I told you this, I was at Grant Park in 2008. I have followed your career very closely. You have been an inspiration to me and impacted my own career. There are very few women that I can think of that have had such an impact.
What a lovely thing to say.
Experience. So
that means a lot to me. Thank you for saying that to me. So, I appreciate it. Well, this is a great podcast. I could have sat here all day.
Thank you.
Quite delightful.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Work Friends, a podcast from Argent. Listen and follow on all podcast platforms. Subscribe to the Argent YouTube channel for more clips and bonus content. And follow us on Instagram @Argent for all the latest. And before you go, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment. It means so much to us. I'm Sally Christensen, and we'll see you next time.
Work Friends.
Work Friends is produced by Gina Marinelli with editing by Ryan Woldoff. Our theme music is by Karina DePiano and Melanie Naima. This episode was recorded at Podstream Studios in New York, New York.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.